You're listening to Flavour on Cambridge 105.
It's 12 o'clock on Saturday the 4th of May and you are listening to Flavour on Cambridge 105 with Matt Bentman, Ruth Reyes and Alan Alder.
On today's programme we find out about Nana Mexico, the independent restaurant on Regent Street and its support for the community.
And close to Nana Mexico on Regent Street is Ushi that sells bubble tea. But what is bubble tea?
There's been a lot in the news this week about bees and the decision of the European community to ban neonicotinoids. But is the bee problem more subtle than that? We interview Alison Benjamin, author of the book A World Without Bees.
Flavour's wine critic Tom Lewis often describes wine as being crowd pleasers or wines for geeks. Today he explains all, and in doing so gives innumerable tips to help you choose your wine. And we visit the Ely Gin Company to find out what they're up to.
In addition, Dr. Sue Bailey tells us about food additives. And we bring you the Cambridge Food News and our review of the food ideas in today's papers. So, let's begin. Ruth?
Of all the gin joints in all the world, she had to walk into mine. It's one of the most well-known lines from, in my opinion, one of the best films in the world, Casablanca. And gin is becoming heavily popular again. With the 20s back in style and bars dedicated to gin alone, opening left, right and centre, the Ely Gin Company is a unique niche in the gin world, offering fruit gins and even jams made from the byproducts. I spoke with James, the man behind the brand, about what the hype's all about and what his gins bring to the table.
So why did you start? Is it Ely Gin Company?
The Ely Gin Company, that's right. Well, it came from several different angles, really. I had for a long time done hedgerow wines, which is wine made out of blackberries or damsons or whatever you find in the hedge. And frankly, these were not brilliant. and I basically ended up with a garage full of wine that nobody were going to drink. But at the same time, I was experimenting, like a lot of people do, with slow gin.
Right.
And the slow gin turns out very well. Slow gin's a very nice drink. And I sort of put the two ideas together. So what happens if you make slow gin but using other fruits? So blackberry gin or something like that. And that went down with the family a lot better than the wine did. And at the same time, I was looking for a career change. So I went down that path. Basically, I wonder if this stuff that I'm making that everyone says is so good is going to sell. And thought I'd give it a try.
Oh, good. So when did you start?
Just over a year ago now. The first trading day was on Ely Market, and it was, I believe, the 31st of March, something like the last weekend of March, and so we, of course, just passed that now.
Yeah.
So, it's going really well. Yeah, at the moment, the gin company is still evenings and weekends.
Right.
The first year, really, I mean, I don't know if this stuff is going to sell. Let's see if it sells at all. And we got through that, and it does,
good.
I'm happy to say. And then this next year is really, okay, well, where, you know, how far can we build it?
Right.
So I've got the basis in now. I'm selling confidently through the market. I've got regulars. I'm selling in 7 or 8 different shops now. So, this is build-up time now. No, it's going well. I've got all my processes settled down. It's all consistent. You know, every batch is more or less the same. So it's looking good now.
Well, that's good. So you said this is build-up period time. Where are you building up to? Where do you think it'll go?
Yeah, anywhere that'll take me. Yeah, I mean, the word is getting out. I'm doing a lot more shows, craft fairs, that sort of thing now. And combining with those, obviously, people get to know the product, get to know the name, and so I can then approach shops in that region and say, look, you know, I went to the craft fair this weekend and sold, I don't know, 200 bottles and got great response, so I think you should take this on. And so it starts.
Excellent.
So it's growing.
Cool, that's really good. So what exactly do you sell? Because I remember when I saw your products at the Anglia Wines?
Anglia Wines, yeah, in Ely High Street, that's right.
That one. And they were tiny little bottles, so you sell more? Is it just those?
Well, I've got
ones?
Three different sizes.
Okay.
And at the moment, 5 different flavours. So, yeah, I mean, small, medium, large, where the large one is a half litre bottle. But okay. I've got three citrus flavours now, grapefruit, orange and lemon. Mm. And they are complemented by two berries, which are blackberry and raspberry. And then there's a straight gin as well.
Okay.
But there are three more flavours in the pipeline. So really? At least two of those will come out this year.
Oh, excellent.
One of them I'm still working to get it right. But two of those are very close.
Nice. Are you willing to disclose what they are?
No, they are secrets.
Excellent. Something to look forward to then.
Yes, and I'm also not sure exactly which order they'll come out in. But no, we've got two very close. I'm quite excited about those.
Cool. Which one's your favourite?
I get asked that so many times. Which one's the best? Which one's my favourite? I think at the moment it's actually the orange.
Okay.
It does vary with the seasons. So the orange is a really sweet one. It's the sweetest one. And it's a great summer drink. But, for example, in the autumn, I mean, not that it's the best or the worst, but in the autumn the blackberry just outsells all the others. It's very seasonal. Surprisingly seasonal. But my favourite, probably the raspberry, in general.
Cool. And I was just in the wine place. And then I just saw the packaging, and it's really nice. How did you come up with it?
Well, a lot of thought went into that. The style that I have gone for is really Art Deco.
Definitely.
Now, in my mind, rightly or wrongly, gin is firmly associated with the 1920s. And it so happens that I also really like Art Deco. And so it was, for me, a no-brainer that the two should go together on the bottle. I worked with a design house in Impington.
Okay.
I'm not an artist, but the lady I worked with managed to translate my ramblings into something that that I think I'm so pleased with it. It looks really good, I think.
It does. It's very attractive.
So we've got the lady in the crown on the front, and I'm often asked who this is. And so we, of course, it's just a lady, but we like to pretend it's Etheldreda from the cathedral.
Nice.
Etheldreda, I'm sure, would have liked a bit of gin of an evening.
Of course she would. Okay, so where do you sell? You said you do a couple of events, and obviously it's at Anglia Wines. So where else?
Yeah, I mean, the main outlet is still the Saturday market in Ely. And
right.
I mean, that is typically very busy anyway. It's a great little market, Ely Market. There's Anglia Wines in the High Street. For people who live in Cambridge, they go to the Bacchanalia. And then it's expanding. So there, as I mentioned earlier, there's about half a dozen, five other shops. They all seem to be out to the south and the west at the moment. North and east is proving challenging, but no, it will go. And then I do attend a lot of craft fairs and such. So last weekend there was a very large game fair, food and game fair craft. I don't forget what they called it up in Norwich.
Right.
There's Parker's Peace coming up in June, a food fair on Parker's Peace. That's going to be very exciting. There's one in Grantchester at the end of June, and so it goes on. But not all local. In September I shall be in Stratford-on-Avon.
Okay.
Back in February I was in Tewkesbury, so I'm getting around.
Yeah, definitely. It's good,
fun. It is fun. I love meeting the people. Let's call them customers. They're not customers until they bought something, right? But just introducing people to the product, particularly at the fairs, we have tasters so people can try it. And sure, not everyone likes it. It's not to everyone's taste. But even getting that immediate feedback and finding out why, like it's too sweet or you know, too dry or whatever, just don't like raspberries or I don't know. getting that feedback is, I love it. It's really interesting, and I just like meeting the people as much as anything else. The fair up in Norwich last weekend was ever so busy, and really good cross section of people as well. It was great fun. Thoroughly enjoyed it. I get asked a lot on how to drink. How do you drink fruit gin?
Actually, yeah.
That question comes up all the time. What do I do with this stuff now I've bought it? And of course, everyone's got different tastes. Citrus ones, the raspberry, it's not a citrus fruit, the grapefruit and the lemon, those are particularly good just as your gin and tonic. And they just add an extra fruity dimension to it. Something like the raspberry, which we've got on the table in front of us here, is fantastic just on ice. And I'm told, although I've never tried it, it goes really well in champagne.
Really?
I imagine the colour is fantastic.
And
then something like the blackberry. Now, if you want to be really decadent, you you crack open a bottle of that, get some really good vanilla ice cream, and put the two together in a bowl. Oh, that's good.
Oh, that sounds good.
That is good.
So where do you actually get your fruits?
Well, of course, it would be very nice to be able to say I get them all locally. citrus groves are not all that common around here, so
no.
They are, of course, from abroad. And the other problem is that I do need a year-round supply.
Of course.
So we talked about blackberries in the autumn, which is great, but I need them in the spring and in the summer. I have to source them from elsewhere, but all the products are made with real fruit. I don't use syrups or colours or flavourings or anything. It's basically just three ingredients. Well, four, I suppose. There's the gin, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
Real fruit, a touch of sugar. And then it's just a question of patience. But yeah, it's all real fruit. And where I can, I get it locally. And then if I can't, then, you know, needs must and all.
Yeah.
But the other thing that you didn't see in the shop in the high street is that as a byproduct, the gin company makes jams. So,
really?
Well, I make the fruit gin, and
right.
At the end of that, I've got this vat of gin-sodden raspberries, which seems a shame to throw away, doesn't it? So
yeah.
I make those into jam, and I make the grapefruits and the other citrus into marmalades. And they go out on that grapefruit marmalade. I can't keep that in stock. But, people have to realise I can only make as much as that as I sell of grapefruit gin.
Of course.
Yeah, like I say, it's a byproduct, and that's cool. Really only available on the market in Ely. So I'm going to make the trip for that one.
Oh, also makes it a reason to come to Ely.
Oh, there are many reasons to come
exactly.
to Ely. Yeah, if you needed an excuse, there's one. But, well, where next? I think world domination is, of course, on the cards.
Of course.
No, it would be good to, I think, put Ely on the map for... I mean, it's great that we have the cathedral here and the tourists trade that brings in, but we'd like to have something else to put Ely on the map, some other reason, at least in my mind.
Yeah,
so we talk about Plymouth gin, we talk about London gin, to a certain extent Edinburgh gin, so let's talk about Ely gin now. It's different to the others, it's got fruit in it. It's exciting colours, got great label. And it's great. The word was getting out.
That's good.
It's very exciting, it really is.
So there we go, world domination, jams, and some pretty banging fruit gins. I tasted the raspberry one, and I can certainly see why it's James's overall favourite. Definitely going to have to try the blackberry and vanilla ice cream suggestion, because that sounds amazing. Check out his website for more gins, suggestions for serving, or head to Ely on a Saturday to see gins for themselves. Today is actually the Eel Festival in Ely, so today would be a great day to drop by.
Now let's hear about one item that's been in the news a lot this week. The European Union voted for a 2-year ban on a class of pesticides known as neonicotinoids that has been associated with the collapse of bee populations. However, it was reported on Thursday that the US government found multiple causes for the collapse of the honeybees. For example, the large parasitic varroa mite. This is a mite that latches onto the bee's back, looks like a backpack, and was identified as the single most damaging factor. But campaigners have said that the report was a missed opportunity to build a case for action against the pesticide. So what is the truth? Is it largely due to the pesticide? Or is the problem caused by several factors? Perhaps the research isn't yielding definitive answers. Last year, Alan spoke with Alison Benjamin, author of A World Without Bees. Alison spent several months reviewing research evidence and speaking with beekeepers in the US and Britain.
Bees seem to be having a particularly bad time in most parts of the world. In America, every year they seem to lose about a third of their bees. They've got about 2.2 million colonies, so you can imagine a third of that is a lot of bees. And in different parts of Europe, France, Germany, they've been having lots of problems with bee deaths, and Italy and many parts of Europe.
Right, so it's a really serious problem then.
Mm.
Okay. What would be the effect of that? Aren't there other insects that pollinate plants?
I mean, there are a lot of insects that pollinate, you know, moths and butterflies and different types of bees as well. But the honeybee is a particular, we call it the master pollinator. It's designed specifically, you know, with pollination in mind. It's very efficient. And moreover, you can transport your bees around to orchards and to fields in order to pollinate. So, you know, very important for agriculture.
If flowers aren't pollinated, the fruits don't develop, presumably.
Yes, that's right. Insects pollinate about 70% of everything we eat. They don't pollinate cereals and grains, but if you think of all our vegetables and nuts, and a lot of the feed that goes to animals is all pollinated by bees. So no bees, sounds odd, but no bees means you probably wouldn't have kind of cows and beef and pork to eat, or, you know, sky-high prices, because there'd be a scarcity. They also pollinate cotton, so you can imagine have a problem with our clothes if we didn't have bees pollinating.
So the price of jeans will rocket.
Yeah, chocolate as well is pollinated by a type of bee.
It gets worse and worse. So why are they under pressure? I thought it was just wet British weather that was doing it.
Bees have got three main problems. They have a parasite, a horrible parasite called the varroa mite, which, if you can imagine a monkey sitting on your back and sucking your blood, that's a bit like a varroa mite on the back of a bee. And it weakens the bee and spreads disease, so really pretty horrible. And they become quite resistant to the chemicals that the beekeepers have been using to keep their numbers down. And then we've got poor nutrition. So we've got acres and acres and acres of land just planted with one food source, or one plant, and these monocultures, you know, they don't give the bees the diversity in the diet that they need. Like, we need a diverse diet, so do bees, and particularly things like cranberries or sunflowers. Their pollen is particularly poor in nutrition. And then there's the pesticides that are sprayed all over these plants. We don't really know, we haven't really got to the bottom of what the impact of pesticides is in the field, but we do know from laboratory trials that they can have awful impact on the bees' communication system and on their immune system.
So it's not necessarily the case that it kills them, it just it disrupts their communication.
Yes, it's the sublethal effects that are really causing problems for bees. But as I say, we haven't really got to the bottom of that. But we do know it must be a combination of those three things, parasites, the poor nutrition and those pesticides.
Yeah. What about water, the fact that it is drier, certainly in Britain it's drier. In America they're using a lot of water. I think that they were sending to agriculture is now going to rapidly expanding cities. Does that have any effect?
Well, bees definitely need water. They feed off plants for the pollen, which is the protein, and the nectar, which is the carbohydrate, which they turn into honey. They also need water as well. So, yeah, less water, but again, they're not going to be so... their immune system is, you know, probably compromised as well.
When I read the book, there were so many different, or there are so many different, I suppose, theories as to why bees are declining. And it started to seem to me that everybody had their pet theory, and it reminded me really of the reaction to the riots in Britain in summer. Everybody just trotted out their own pet theory. It's gangs or it's something else. So what's the quality of the research? Is there much research being done?
There's a lot of research being done, but from researching the book, it became very clear that according to which, you know, if you're an expert in varroa, then you would be saying that varroa was definitely the cause of, you know, the bees dying. You'd be calling for more money to go into research for varroa. But if you were an expert in Nosema, which is another sort of gut parasite that the bees suffer from, that the Spanish have done a lot of work in this area, you know, you'd be calling for more money to go into Nosema research. You know, it very much seems to be what your speciality is what you've got a vested interest in, trying to get more money into researching those areas. So there is a lot of research going on, and probably not enough into the pesticides. Actually, one of the problems seems to be that the pesticide companies are the ones that do research into pesticides, and they're not always being asked the right questions by the agencies that regulate pesticides. I mean, at the moment, the tests are very much looking at how they affect the adult bee and looking at lethal doses, where it's the sublethal doses that are the problem, and it's probably the impact they're having on the larvae and the eggs and the development of the bees rather than the adult bees themselves.
And some companies like Häagen-Dazs, I think, are putting money into research. How significant is that, would you say?
A lot of companies, Häagen-Dazs, the co-op, have got involved and got behind bees, and I think it all helped. I think think it, some companies, obviously, it's good for marketing as well. You know, Häagen-Dazs do make the point that a lot of their flavours for their ice creams are dependent on bee pollination.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
You know, every little helps, probably.
Is there anything we can do as sort of consumers and citizens?
Going back to the co-op, they banned a number of pesticides on co-op produced fruit and vegetables.
Right.
So we could, as consumers, be supporting those companies that are
doing
the
that
right
sort of
thing.
Yeah.
And we could be writing to our MPs demanding, you know, more research. And the European Union have been quite good at banning certain pesticides, but the UK has decided, you know, not to follow suit. So, you know, we need to put more pressure on our MPs when it comes to pesticides.
Right.
But we could look at how we could make our environment more bee-friendly to help, not just honeybees, but there's bumblebees and there's hundreds of solitary bees as well who all pollinate. And what they need is good, diverse, year-round food. We could make sure that we're planting in our gardens bee-friendly plants, and we're planting them sort of that come out early in the year and are flowering late in the year as well.
And presumably less decking.
Much less decking. Yeah, less concrete, less drives. And we could be lobbying our councils to make sure the parks are much more bee-friendly and all the green space. You know, we need more wildflower meadows rather than sort of those civic displays with the pansies, you know, tunias, which are pretty useless. Bedding plants and double-headed flowers are pretty useless for bees. What we need is more wildflowers. So keep a bit of your garden wild.
And you've got hives as well, haven't you? How easy is it for people to embark on that?
It's a good idea if you're going to keep bees to go on a course and get an idea about what it entails, because it is a responsibility. There's 50,000 of them in a hive at the height of the summer.
Right.
You might want to talk to your neighbours about it. I mean, bees will only, they defend their territory. As a beekeeper, you have to open a hive once a week in the summer just to check everything's okay, and you might need to give them a bit more space to make and store their honey. That's when they might get a bit tetchy, and you might want to let your neighbours know. I mean, they're all they're interested in is collecting the pollen and the nectar.
Even in the city, they'll find enough to eat.
In a city, it's probably better. There's probably a more diverse range of flowers all year round.
Yeah, because there isn't the monoculture
described. That's right, yes, and probably not the pesticide use as well. So anecdotally, honeybees seem to be doing better in cities.
Oh, really? Mm. That is a surprise, right? Mm.
That was Alison Benjamin, author of A World Without Bees. So what are your thoughts on the problem, Alan?
Well, from reading the book, I couldn't help but think that the environmental pressures of poor nutrition, mass transportation, unhelpful winter weather, the varroa mite, and the effect of pesticides all lower the bees' resistance and make them vulnerable to viruses. It's also apparent that if research is sponsored by a particular company, the results often let that company's products off the hook. But it's obviously a very complex area, really, and, you know, who knows who's got the right answer. Let's just hope the ban on pesticide does work.
Definitely. A Cambridge restaurant I walk past every day is Nana Mexico. I'd always assumed it was part of a chain, but I was wrong. It's an independent, and more than that, it's involved in some good community support. Julian Clover of Drive on Cambridge 105 reports.
Now, support for the homeless is one of those services you think we should really be able to do without in Cambridge, but sadly, it's very much a reality. And for charities such as Winter Comfort, well, we're kind of pleased they're there. And that particular charity has the support of the Nana Mexico restaurant. And I've got with me here a collection of people. First of all, I've got Luis Navarro. He's from Nana Mexico. Next to him is Alex Hughes, and he was until recently doing some work experience at the restaurant. And finally, James Martin is here from Winter Comfort. Good afternoon, everybody.
Hello there.
Good afternoon.
I've got a packed studio this afternoon. So I guess we should probably start with James and maybe just tell us a little bit more about Winter Comfort, because there are a few homeless charities in Cambridge. And it's sometimes getting the distinction between what everybody does.
Yeah, it can be quite confusing. So Winter Comfort, we're a day centre based on Victoria Avenue in Cambridge. And we provide welfare services for people who are rough sleeping and vulnerably housed, so people can come in and get free breakfast, access to laundry facilities, help and advice and support to get into accommodation, and so on and so forth. We also deliver learning development opportunities for clients, so people can come and learn to improve their English, do DIY skills, a whole range of stuff that we offer.
Because I guess that's one of the problems if you're homeless, one of many, I guess, but actually finding your way back onto the track view English isn't so good, or if you're lacking in skills, and you kind of need some help, really, to be able to get those skills to go forward.
Yeah, it's really difficult, especially if you've been out of work for a while, and the jobs market is so competitive now that it's very difficult. So the sort of link with Nano Mexico for us was really good. We've got a couple of social enterprises, Food for Food, which do a catering service for companies, and we've got Food for Food Community Cafe, which is based in St Andrew's Hall in Chesterton, and our guys can volunteer and get work experience within both those social enterprises in catering, and Nano Mexico approached us to see whether we could work together, and I think that's sort of where Lewis came in, and could provide work placements, paid work placements for our service users, which is really good because then it's more experience.
And everybody CV. Getting experience, people feel that they're getting somewhere as well, I guess.
Yes, it's great. It's really good.
Yeah. So, Lewis, what made you sort of think, right, we're going to do some stuff with for a good cause and we're going to be doing it with Winter Comfort?
I think for us it's a privilege because although we are a business and that's the what we do is trying to engage with the community.
Mm.
And definitely this, believe it or not, in Cambridge is a pressing need. So we just wanted to engage with our community while we do business. And this is a great opportunity. With the support of a charity that it's doing great work, we just try to pretty much copy what they do, incorporate these people into a training scheme that is paid by us and that gives them a little extra set of skills.
And something giving and confidence. Back, yeah, and giving back to the community along the way. It's
along the way, there is nothing to prevent businesses, small or big, from doing this kind of engagement with the community while pursuing their business purposes.
Mm. James, Alex. Hello. My notes were my hello. You did some work experience at the restaurant. How did you get on? Did you enjoy it?
I did indeed. It was a wonderful experience, and you learn a new cuisine. And you learn a new, renew your catering skills.
Had you done stuff before in the catering field?
I hadn't actually, but I've been working through James's Food for Food Community Cafe, volunteering. In fact, I've been volunteering today. And of course, you can learn your skills through working in volunteering. And of course, with the help of Lewis, working in Nano Mexico, you learn a new cuisine and you learn new skills.
Had you actually been homeless yourself?
I had, yes, but this opportunity arrived not long after my mum had passed away.
Right.
So it came, I was at a very low ebb at that time, so the work experience coming along when it did was a real, is what I needed.
I guess it's difficult, isn't it, because, you know, you lose somebody close, and even though you've probably got friends maybe around you, you know, friends go out and they do stuff during the day and you're not always there, and it's a bit of a hole and all sorts of things sort of hit into each other.
Exactly. But the work experience is wonderful. It's wonderful, and it looks good on your CV as well. And also within that, my work experience, I did a food hygiene course, which can be part of your work experience as well. And it goes very well on your CV and helps with future job applications.
I'm sure that's the case. And Lewis, at the moment with the city council doing the 5-star food hygiene thing, it's actually sort of doubly important to be able to be on top of that sort of stuff.
Absolutely important, but that is why I think as a business, it's very important to work alongside charities or organizations that know how to do and what to do. So that's why Winter Comfort comes into the picture. But others, like Illuminate, we work very closely with them. So we could, as management, the management team of Nano Mexico and the staff of Nano Mexico, learn communication skills, how to engage, how to motivate ourselves to these kind of tasks. So it's thanks to Illuminate, to Winter Comfort, and to the people that come to us to do this work experience that these things work.
Now, that's quite interesting, because aside from the charitable aspect of this, you're actually learning stuff yourself as a business.
It's a tremendous experience. I think I've been saying to Alex, not only what we have learned from him, the boost in confidence to him, but to my staff, the new set of ideas, beliefs, how to engage, how to do things, it is tremendous. People really find that an extra commitment to their everyday work.
Mm. How long has the charity been running for, James?
Winter Comfort's been operating in Cambridge for 21 years. So, yeah, a long time. Started off.
That's quite a while, isn't it?
Yeah. It's still known as a bus amongst quite a few of our service users. Started off as a double-decker bus.
Oh, really?
In 9 yards, yeah, literally a double-decker bus, giving out soup and socks. And it's come a long way in that sort of 20 years to provide what it does now.
Yeah, absolutely. How long since you left the bus behind?
We left the bus. It was a long time ago. It was mid-80s, I think.
Okay, so that was just pretty much the early days.
We've been based in Overstream House ever since.
Mm.
And that was Julian Clover with a report first broadcast on Cambridge 105's Evening Drive programme. Nana Mexico is on Regent Street, and its menu features such Mexican delights as burritos, my favourite, quesadillas, tacos and tortas, and such Cambridge delicacies as cakes from afternoon teas.
My favourite.
Also my favourite. It's very nice. I was there the other day, got a burrito, delicious, and well worth a visit. Julian Clover's Drive programme is also well worth a listen.
Yeah.
You're listening to Flavour on Cambridge 105.
And now for an update on food news in Cambridge. And remember, you can follow Flavour on Twitter at Flavour105, where we provide a news service.
Aromi, the Sicilian cafe on Bennett Street, opened last Sunday and very quickly filled up. The interest it has generated has sustained all week. A second Sicilian cafe, restaurant and bar is opening soon on Regent Street, but it has no connection with Aromi.
There's another beer festival at the Green Man in Grantchester this bank holiday weekend, and there's music too on Saturday, Sunday and Monday.
There's also a beer festival at the Kingston Arms in Kingston Street. It started on Thursday and it runs through to Wednesday next week. The Kingston has restarted its Thursday night barbecues again too.
A new Turkish restaurant is opening soon on East Street.
And there's a Cambridge Bake Off. If you're interested, have a look at the Cambridge Bake Off's Facebook page for details. You need to live or work in Cambridge to enter. The judges include Cambridge Cookery School's Tina Rush, The Secluded Tea Party's Miss Sue Flay, award-winning pâtissière Deborah Bonis, Eat Cambridge organiser Caroline Biggs, and Tucker Gardner's John Adamson. The closing date for entry is the 10th of May.
The Art of Meat, Arbery's excellent butcher, which you can find in Arbery Court, makes its own sausages and does some specials each week. This week, butcher John West has made Toulouse sausages with white wine, garlic and catra épice, and an Afrikaans recipe, Burverse. There's also some spatchcock poussin available.
And the monthly pop-up restaurants at Fitzbillies are going strong. They take place on the first Wednesday of each month, and the one this month was a New York-style deli evening and proved very popular with a queue that was outside the restaurant at one stage. The next is on the 5th of June, and it's a barbecue night.
A new bubble tea cafe has opened on Regent Street. It's called Ushi. Why not try it out? But what is bubble tea? Alan asked Dr. Sue Bailey, food scientist, about it.
I don't know how much you know about bubble tea, Sue, but there's a place on Regent Street opening up selling Ushi, which is a sort of bubble tea. Is that something, as a food scientist, you're aware of?
In fact, I came across bubble tea for the first time last year, and I was just doing a little bit of investigation on this because I hadn't heard of what bubble tea was at all before. And what it is these little sort of spheres of typically often tapioca that is suspended in a tea drink, and it can be a sort of a milky tea or it can be different types of flavourings there. And the idea is that you sort of then squish this bubble. And I think you can also get different types of flavoured bubbles. I'd be very interested to find out what the type of bubble tea is they're selling there. But it's become actually quite popular in London. I gather there's quite a few bubble tea cafes. It started, I think, in China and Korea. And so it's quite well known in different Asian cultures. Mm. And obviously, if you've got a percentage of Asian people within the population or foodies who want to try something new,
yes,
then
we're always interested in trying new things.
Indeed. Yeah. I will definitely be going and paying a visit there and seeing what it actually tastes like. I've actually come across bubble tea in a can in one of our local one of those local shops in Mill Road that absolutely sells everything. I think you'll know exactly
yes,
which one I
right,
mean.
Yeah.
That was bubble tea in a can, so that was very interesting.
Oh, right, I'll have to go and try it. But you've not drunk it yet.
I haven't actually. I haven't. No, I, 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 I was telling a lie in the sense that I have the can, it's sitting on my desk. I'm waiting for some of my food science colleagues to sample this bubble tea with me. So it would be very interesting to see what they think of it as well.
Okay, right. Well, thanks very much.
And you can buy those tins of bubble tea from Al Amin on Mill Road.
Now, we used to read a lot about E-numbers. These were the food additives that had been approved by the European Union. But what's happened to them? Alan asked Dr. Sue Bailey about their disappearance. Not that he's missing them.
Sue, we're going to talk about what's added to foods today. And it used to be the case that when you looked at ingredients, you'd find a lot of E-numbers. They don't seem to exist anymore. What's happened to them?
Ooh, manufacturers got very scared off E-numbers. And this has actually been so for about the last probably 15 years, I would say, because there was a book that was published, E for Additives, and at that stage the EU had legislated to have E-numbers as a sort of safety thing for consumers, so that if they saw E whatever, then they knew it had been passed by the EU, they knew it was therefore safe. But it rather backfired, because when this book was published, the consumer suddenly went, oh, eek, for additives, and suddenly realised that a lot of their foods had got additives in them, and it really, and consumers got a bit scared. Right. And they put a lot of pressure on manufacturers. And therefore, then the manufacturers decided, let's just call the food additives by a more normal sounding name and not put an E number
in there.
So
they're still there.
Oh yes, the additives are still there, okay. But the E numbers, you don't
but
get
they're
to
not,
see them.
They're not given that sort of E code.
Not given
anymore.
An E code at
right.
all.
So give us an example of an additive that we might come across which would perhaps once have been coded with an E number.
Something like, for example, ascorbic acid, you could
which
have...
Which is vitamin C.
That would have been coded with an E number.
Right.
But obviously, from a consumer point of view, you'd rather see either vitamin C, because you know what that is.
Yeah.
Ascorbic acid, yes, you see that on packaging as well. And consumers are a little less scared than seeing this sort of scary E whatever it is, and they just don't know. For example, something very simple like extract of rosemary has actually got an E number, E392. But if you put E392 on there, people think, what?
Yeah.
And they wouldn't even think that that was something
extract of
quite
rosemary.
Pleasant.
Yeah,
yes.
Extract of rosemary just sounds rather more pleasant
it
than
it does indeed.
E392.
Yes.
Yeah. And things like monosodium glutamate, I know, is still added to food as a flavour enhancer. That, I guess, had an E number at one time.
Yes, indeed. Well, it's still got an E number, except we don't see it on the packaging. It's E624. And there's legislation still. The Food Standards Agency has a whole list of E numbers of different types of additives, whether they're preservatives, stabilisers, flavour enhancers, whatever. And they have still the E numbers attached to them because it gives the security of knowing that there has been research carried out to show what the safe parts per million actually is for that particular additive.
I know you've been looking at stock cubes and what's in stock cubes. Stock cubes being things that I think most of us use at least some of the time.
Yes.
Any surprises? I would have thought a stock cube, let's say a chicken stock cube, would contain, I don't know, an extract of chicken and something to preserve it, like maybe salt.
Well,
have you found more than just that?
I have indeed.
Right.
I have indeed. And I was looking actually at four different types of stock cubes, and the variation in ingredients is absolutely amazing. Typically, salt is one of the highest ingredients in three of the ones I was looking at. And then you have all sorts of other things in there as well. Things like yeast extract. Yep, that's fair enough. But then you also have some sugar, or you have some glucose syrup, and then you have chicken powder, for example.
What? I dread to think what that is. Any idea? Do they come clean?
They haven't come clean in that sense. And in fact, chicken fat on this particular one rates slightly higher than chicken powder. So you've obviously got a bit more fat in there and a nice bit of dehydrated chicken to just give a tiny little bit of extra flavour. But comparing it to another more organic stock cube, that's actually got some chicken meat in it as well as chicken fat, and a percentage of 7% as compared to the other one that's got fat and chicken powder, which is 3%. And then, in fact, on a couple of the other ones I looked at, a percentage isn't given, or the percentage is lower anyway. Chicken does actually is mentioned on all four of the ones I looked at, but in very varying amounts.
I'm surprised, given that certainly in one of them it's 2% chicken fat and 1% chicken powder, that they can do the job of adding a chickeny sort of flavour. Or is there something else in there that does that?
There is other things in there that will give a sort of chicken flavour. Things like yeast extract will give a sort of a depth of flavour. And then you will have, in some cases, flavourings in some of these non-specified as to what the flavourings are. These might be what's known as a nature identical flavouring, which is an artificially made flavouring made to taste like it's chicken. And there's a lot of very clever flavourists out there who spend a lot of their time combining chemical bases to actually then create a nice,
but they don't
realistic
have to,
chicken flavour.
They don't have to declare what those things are.
No, not at all. No,
because
they don't.
People could have allergies to them.
Well, that they, if there is anything in there that could be potentially allergic, then that's something that one needs to be a little bit careful of. For example, celery is a potential allergen for some people, and the ones that I was looking at that do have celery powder or some form of celery seed or something added in there do actually have to state it as a potential allergen. So yes, they have to be careful.
Right, so if you see flavourings on a pack, then you can feel reasonably confident that there won't be anything there that
would be potentially harmful.
Commonly,
yes, exactly.
Allergens.
Yeah.
Any other surprises?
Well, interestingly, in terms of colouring, you want a nice sort of deep colour in your stock potentially, and this is one of the things that if you make your own chicken stock, often they're actually perhaps quite pale. So this is where the companies are quite clever, and if you have a, I'm just going to take one out of this pack now. Let's open it up and have a quick look. And yes, it's a nice... Oh, it's the colour of the table almost, isn't it?
Yes, it's a...
It's a nice, quite sort of dark, beigey colour. And that, in a number of them, has been added in by a caramel. On the whole, they're safe. It's recommended that if there's children have a very high consumption of other caramel-containing foods, things like drinks and so on, then there needs to be a little bit of caution. But on the whole, again, it's deemed to be quite safe. It has an E number, therefore it's deemed to be safe.
One of these products, and I don't think we ought to mention, which products we're looking at in particular, but I can see one of these products has 7% chicken meat and 7% chicken fat. So if you do take the time, presumably, to look at the packs, you can...
Oh, yes.
Get something that's probably of reasonable quality. I don't know how many people do stand in supermarkets reading stock cube packs, but perhaps people would be advised
perhaps
to.
They should. Perhaps they should, actually.
Do you notice price?
I was looking at price. The price isn't that much different. I haven't done an exact analysis of what, quantity and the amount it would make up and what the price would be. That would be an interesting thing to do. I might do that on Sunday, perhaps.
Right, okay.
But... No, it's very interesting how some of them, for example, this one with monosodium glutamate, I think that's the one which, in fact, I have been using myself recently, and I think I'm going to probably take that off my kitchen shelf.
Yes, well, it is a well-known product, that one. Yeah, okay.
By the way, the stock cubes that seem to be the best, or at least they contain the most chicken, were called Callow Organic. Thanks to Sue for that piece, and remember you can send your food-related questions to flavour@cambridge105.fm for Sue to answer.
And let's move on to wine. Alan asked Tom Lewis, our wine critic, about the terms crowd-pleasing and geeky wines, and Tom provided some really good information that should help you to make a choice that would suit your taste.
I suppose for me the key difference between what makes a wine crowd-pleasing against geeky is fruit. Having lots of fruit is the basis of that modern style of wine that we're used to now and that we maybe find in the supermarket. A crowd-pleasing wine is going to have lots of ripe primary fruit. A wine that appeals to the geeky anoraki types like myself will eschew fruit, maybe in favour of something a little bit more elusive, or what I consider to be more interesting, something like texture. So essentially the difference is between taste and feel.
Right. So does that mean then that crowd pleasers are generally fine with or without food, whereas the geeky wines are more generally nicer with food?
I think geek wines are definitely food wines. So a crowd pleaser will have lots of ripe fruit. There'll be a nice quaffer. But to me, food and wine is or drinking wine is always about having it with food. And so therefore, I'm looking for a wine that's going to match up with some food generally.
Because some people will taste a wine and they say, well, I don't like it, but they haven't tasted it with food.
Definitely, there are certain wines, food wines are intended to be had, to be drunk with food, and if you just try them on their own and you haven't regularly sort of had them with food, there'll be things in there that perhaps you don't like on its own. Those of us that sort of taste wines on a regular basis can say, well, this isn't necessarily as pleasant as it will be when I match it with some food.
Right, okay. And just go through what you mean by fruit. What are the sort of common fruity flavours that you would find?
If I talk about a wine being fruit forward or having a lot of fruit, what I mean is it's got a lot of ripe, very primary fruit. So if it's a Cabernet Sauvignon, I'd expect lots of blackcurrant. If it's a Sauvignon Blanc, it would be gooseberries or tropical fruit. A Pinot Grigio may taste of apples and pears. Now, these flavours in themselves are not bad to have in a wine. They're good. They're an important part of the flavour profile. But if that's the only thing in there, then essentially you're drinking alcoholic fruit juice.
And the alternative is what you would call secondary flavours.
Secondary flavours are the sort of slightly less obvious, more elusive flavours. These are things like spice, licorice, pencil shavings, maybe leathery aromas in reds. In a white wine, often what I'm looking for is minerality. And minerality can be described as the flavour of wet stones, if wet stones could have a flavour. That would be in something like a Riesling or a Grüner Veltliner. In an oak-aged white Burgundy, there'll be some oakiness, a little bit of yeastiness from aging on the lees.
Right, so it's quite key really to know whether a wine's going to be high or low in fruit. How do you know?
First of all, there's no absolute way of knowing until you try the wine itself. You have to try it first to know what it's going to taste like, but there are some stylistic clues that you can pick up on. For me, the New World is not just a geographic region, it's also a style of winemaking. So the New World could be Australia, California, but it also can be inland Spain, southern France. In that kind of warmer climate, the wines are going to be more fruit-driven. When it's warmer, the grapes are riper, and therefore the flavour compounds on the skins are going to be more developed. In the old world, so cooler climate areas, and again, you know, there are parts of California that are distinctly cool, parts of Australia too, there's going to be less fruit because the grapes don't get to the same level of ripeness. So as well as less fruit, there'll be less alcohol, the acidity will be higher, and the tannins in a red wine can also be higher. So these are the kind of things that are going to make a wine more food-friendly and less of an easy quaffer.
And if they're higher acidity, you've said before that they therefore would go well with food.
Absolutely. The acidity, particularly in a white wine, is what's going to cut through things. So if you're having it with cheese, creamy pasta or pork, then you'll need a higher level of acidity to cut through that and refresh the palate. Again, if in terms of a red, they'll be higher in tannins, and that will stand up to things like lamb or beef, that kind of meat flavours.
But there are stars of wine, aren't there, which are known for being low in fruit. Why would that be?
There are certain wines you know you're not going to expect a lot of fruit in them.
Yeah.
And that's due either to the grapes or the way that they're made. Sherry has almost no fruit at all. The Palomino grape that makes Fino Sherry just has no fruit characteristics. And when you're drinking a sherry, it's all about the acidity and the refreshment that it brings. My favourite white varieties, Riesling and especially Grüner Veltliner, very low in overt fruit. They do have aromas. In the case of Grüner Veltliner, it'll be something like celery, pre-lentils. But again, it's generally about the acidity and the mouthfeel and how they work with food. The other type of wine that's going to work well with food is a barrel-aged white. And that's, again, a slightly older school way of making wines. You don't get that crisp freshness. They're going to lose some of the fruit, but what they'll gain is texture and structure.
And what about reds?
A red wine has to have some fruit in order for it to be balanced. You can't, or it would be a very unusual red that has no fruit at all. So within the red, there are tannins that are going to stand up with the protein of meat. So you need some ripeness of the fruit to match off with the bitterness of the tannins.
Okay, but when you talk about wines and you talk about some tasting being fruity wines, that sounds quite appealing. To be honest, it sounds more appealing than wet stones. So why do enthusiasts or geeks not look for fruit so much?
I think ultimately it gets boring. If a wine only tastes of fruit, and it's ripe, simple fruit, then for the first or second wine that you try, that could be very nice. If you keep trying it and that's all you're getting, it's just going to get boring. So I think those of us who try and taste a lot of wines look for something a little bit more elusive, something more unusual about a wine.
So don't you tend to drink wines with fruit at all?
A wine with simple fruit and nothing else could be a nice, light, easy sipper. The sort of thing I can think of is either a Beaujolais or a light German Riesling. These wines are horribly unfashionable, and perhaps with good reason, because of so many bad examples that we've seen over here. But that's not to say there aren't good examples. They're not necessarily cheap, but those would be the light, fruit-driven wines that I'd be interested in. In terms of bigger, more ambitious wines that have more emphasis on their fruit, somewhere like Languedoc, inland Spain, or southern Italy, these are a good source of ripe, easy-drinking crowd pleasers.
What else do you look for in a wine, then, apart from fruit? Presumably the secondary characteristics you mentioned before.
Yeah, absolutely. The sort of secondary aromas, either, you know, the spice or the leather, a bit of gaminess, these things are, to me, are a lot more interesting than simple fruit. But also as the wine ages, the flavour profile changes and you start to pick up flavours, or they start to develop, that you just cannot get in a younger wine. So you'll get sort of undergrowth or aged leather. The other thing that makes a wine interesting is, for me, the elegance of it. What I'd look for is, rather than just sheer volume of fruit flavours, there needs to be some fruit in there, but the elegance of the wine, the purity of expression, is it clean and fresh? Also, I'd look for the acidity. On a wine, it needs to be refreshing. It shouldn't be harsh, like sucking on a lemon. Mm. It should be mouth-filling, complex and linear. Also, I'd look for texture. In a red wine in particular, it should be mouth-filling. It needs to feel firm and grippy. That's going to make it suitable for having with food. And the way I'd sort of describe this is, if you think of the difference between a freshly picked, perfectly ripe apple and one that's been in the fruit bowl for a couple of weeks, the ripe one is fresh and firm and it has a vibrancy about it. The one that's been there for a while has sort of gone a bit soft and flabby and has lost interest. What also makes a wine interesting is the length. If you just try it and drink it, then maybe it's pleasant. But what I'm looking for is, how long do the flavours last on the palate? Do they develop? Do they become more complex and interesting? And then the final part of that is the finish. After you've finished, swallowed the wine, do you still get a sense of the flavours and the texture of the wine on the palate?
Do you think a more sophisticated palate actually means that you enjoy fewer wines?
I think that's a good point. It certainly means that you are more intolerant of any deficiencies, be they technical or stylistic, in a wine. So, a word of warning, developing a palate can result in you not enjoying the wines that you used to like as much. So there is an element of being careful what you wish for.
Are there any wines that you'd recommend for people to try, of either style, really, fruity or the more complex ones?
In terms of geeky wines, I think a good place to start would be Sherry and Riesling. As I've said, there's no fruit in those. They're more about the acidity and the structure. In terms of reds, Pinot Noir is the ultimate geek's wine. It's highly unreliable. It's very light and delicate when it's made well. So, yes, it's an enthusiast's wine. I think definitely they need food, and they maybe need a little bit of getting used to as well. If you're used to a ripe, fruity supermarket wine and you want to know what the fuss is about, there's a risk of finding something that's a little bit too different. So approach it with a little bit of caution and maybe take the advice of a local wine merchant. The other things that you could look for, if you're interested in trying a geekier wine, is something that's older. A wine that's more than 10 years old and that's been designed to age will have flavours and aromas that you just don't get in a younger wine. Or you could look for obscure locations. A wine from Greece, a wine from Austria will be very different from the mainstream sorts that you would see on a supermarket shelf.
And what about crowd pleasers? Is there any you'd recommend there?
I've got some specific recommendations on crowd pleasers. And as we sort of hinted at earlier, these are crowd pleasers that will pass muster with a wine geek.
Mm.
So the first one is from Noel Young Wines. It's the Cape Heights Cabernet Sauvignon from Western Cape. It's got lots of fruit. It's bright, easy and clean. It's a nice, easy drinker. And that one's £6.30. From Cambridge Wine Merchants, this one is a perennial favourite. It's the Mont Rocher Old Vines Carignan, and that's £6.99. And then the final one is from Joseph Barnes. It's the Bergerie de la Bastide, Terre du Sud Rouge, and it's only £5.99. It's an easy-drinking southern French red from Languedoc. So it's got warm, lots of fruit, very approachable. It's a blend of Grenache, Merlot and Sanson.
Mm, right, well, let's hope people try them and enjoy them.
Indeed.
Thanks very much, Tom.
Thank you.
That was useful. I wonder if we should ask listeners to email us any wine-related questions.
That sounds like a good idea to me. You can email us on flavour@cambridge105.fm.
Right, well, let's move on to the newspaper review. We are slightly short of time this week, so we'll just look at a couple of newspapers. Let's begin with the Financial Times, and in it, Rowley Lee has a recipe for duck and sweetbread stew with morels. Rose Cararini's recipe is for vanilla meringue with cream and coffee, and Jancis Robinson's column is very enthusiastic about 2011 ports. Tim Hayward has an article about the overuse of adjectives on food packaging, menus and wine tasting notes. In the Guardian magazine, Hugh Fernie Whittingstall, or HFW as he's referred to on the cover, has the second of his series of three articles about bread. Last week it was yeast-free breads, this week it's buns, brioche and bagels, and next week the pleasures of sourdough. Yotam Ottolenghi has some unusual, naturally, asparagus dishes, Fiona Beckett, Chenin Blanc wines, and in the gardening section, Alice Fowler discusses growing beetroot. The Cook supplement has some very enticing recipes and features. Amongst them, there's the 10 best garlic recipes. Dan Leppard does pears poached in red wine using lemon and vanilla to provide sweet and sour notes. Felicity Cloak gives some local recipes from various parts of Britain. Rosie Sykes from Fitzbillies provides a recipe for the special feature on mangoes, which is cardamom labneh with mango and rose water, and it does sound good. Let's begin with the duck one. Do either of you eat a lot of duck?
I wouldn't say a lot of it, but I do really like it.
A bit too strong for me, I think.
Is it? Yeah, right. I don't eat a lot, but I do like it. There's a stall on the Sunday market that sells free-range duck, which is quite hard to get hold of, as well as duck eggs. And I think they're going to have some duck in later this month. You know, they all grow up and reach maturity together, so there's not a constant flow. Anyway, the duck recipe is seasonal, and it contains morels, which, are in season now.
Where'd you get those from, then?
Well, if you're an explorer of woodland, you might find where they grow, in which case, you know, you'd be wise to keep it to yourself. But otherwise, you could try Lynn's fruit and veg stall in the Daily Market. That's the serve-yourself one. Or the Cambridge Cheese Company in All Saints Passage, who have often got a good selection of fungi. Or you can get dried ones. Sweetbreads are also in season now, but you'd almost definitely have to order them from a butcher. I'd go to the Art of Meat in Arbury or Andrew Northrop and ask them.
Another ingredient that's in season now is asparagus, right?
Yeah, it is. But the frost has knocked it back this week in some places. I think it's suffered at Burwash. They've postponed their asparagus day, which was to have been today. Yotam Ottolenghi's dishes offer asparagus and chive bread pudding, and for grilled asparagus with avocado and horseradish. Again, you can get fresh horseradish from Lynn's stall at the market, unless you know where it grows wild, and I've never managed to find any. And actually, that reminds me, there's some wild food foraging expeditions coming up in Cambridge soon, and if you go to the Food Safari UK website, the dates are given there.
Yeah.
Lots of fun.
We haven't covered much wild food for some time, have we?
No, actually, I was going to do something today on it, but I ran out of time. I'll see if you can start up in June.
As long as I don't have to try any more woodlice.
Oh, all right then. I'll give them to Ruth. In the Cook supplement, the garlic recipes look
good caramelized garlic tart with an almond floor base, for example, which has goat cheese and tarragon in it too. And there's a recipe for a Spanish dish, Ruth. Sopa de ajo?
Mm-hmm.
Garlic, egg, bread and paprika. Is that something you've had?
Oh, I love it. It's one of my favorite dishes, actually.
Oh, right. Okay. Yeah. Well, since we are running out of time, there's also something from my hometown of Liverpool, a recipe for scouse. They're made with beef, and I'm sure we had it made with lamb. And it was served at school with beetroot, which went wonderfully well with it. But I think that's the end of the papers. Run out of time.
Okay, thank you, Alan. That brings us to the end of another show, of course, and many thanks to all of our contributors.
Don't forget to follow Flavour on Twitter, at Flavour105. That's where you'll read about the news we discover ourselves, and we retweet food and drink stories from other Cambridge sources. Next live edition, Saturday the 18th of May at midday, and you can find our previous episodes on our podcast page on the Cambridge 105 website.
Do join us next time. Coming up next is Saturday Lunch.
Goodbye.
Bye.